Hi, this is your host, David Duncan of the Synthaholics Podcast. This week we have the great honor and privilege of having Larry Nemechek with us on the show. Unfortunately, we had some internet connectivity issues, so there will be some sound artifacting in this episode. I have done my best to work around it, but unfortunately some of it will still make it into the show. But please bear with us. This is a great, fantastic talk with Larry. He has some great info. He's working on lots of different projects, and he has some great tidbits about the episode we talk about in this week's Synthaholics.
I found this on Ganymede.
What is it?
Well, it's
Synthaholics.
Welcome to Synthaholics, guys. This is your host, David Duncan. With me, as always, is Aaron O'Brien and Faith Hertzberg. And Larry Nemechek has saved us all!
He did save us.
He is here with us tonight.
And don't you forget it.
Check's in the mail, Larry.
Hopefully no one will ever forget this one.
No, yeah. So we got Larry, and it's been we've been excited to have you on the show. So this is really cool. So we want to get into all your Star Trek knowledge, your depth of knowledge that we may be lacking.
Be careful what you wish for, Lieutenant. You may get it.
Yeah.
That's what you said whenever I asked you to be on the show. It's like, no, I definitely want this.
Right.
I'm okay.
So, one of the biggest questions I had, because, I mean, you have so many tie-ins to all sorts of Star Trek products and Star Trek things that are going on, Larry. Where did you actually get started? Maybe just back up on your history of Star Trek and, like, what got you into it?
Well, the short answer to this, and believe me, you want the short answers, is my ninth grade science teacher, who shamed me into going home and watching because she couldn't believe I wasn't already in the great rerun era. And so thank you, Mrs. Pollard. And I had a million interests, and Star Trek was one of them, but when you're a kid growing up, even in quasi-civilized Oklahoma, in a three or four channel world, and hoping that you'll soon get cable, clubs and fandom and early conventions and all the cool early stuff like the tech manual and the medical reference and the blueprints and the and one crew and one show. But I really early on was a big background fan. Some people were big fans of zines and characters and fan fiction in the early days. But my outlet was always, I just was drawn to the background. I just loved the world. You only had 79 episodes, but you could climb through your TV and just feel like you could live in that world. And, now we have all the pop culture and, media franchise buzzwords like world building and all that. But at the time, that's just to what it was. So I was a big fan first of filling in the gaps that, there were only 79 hours, so we didn't know what everything looked like. And then people would do books and tech manuals and things and try to flesh it out. And you would argue or you would debate the right way to go with something. And eventually all that emerged. And then eventually it was all a moot point because Next Generation started and kind of started filling it all in officially. And then I had tracked a lot of stuff. I love Bijo's Concordance and the tech manuals and all that. And I started doing that again for Next Generation. And eventually my fan zines, when desktop publishing came in, got picked up by the writers at Next Generation. They were using my guidebooks for background because there was no internet, there was no memory alpha, there was no encyclopedia by the Akutas even, and my stuff was what they were using originally. And then when they finally got off their butts at Pocket and licensing and decided that, oh, the Next Generation was big enough to sell a few books over, nonfiction books, then the Next Generation Companion got offered to me to do in 3 months, which grew to 6 months. And it was like a behind-the-scenes guide, not so much a tech manual type concordance, whatever. So, yeah, so that's really what it was. And then after that, it was off and running, and I moved to L.A. with my new family, and my wife worked on Voyager for 5 years, and everything from editing Communicator magazine that used to be the official fan club's, you know, official magazine, and working on the Fat Files overseas, and working on a lot of the licensing projects like the Experience in Las Vegas and doing the museum stuff for that, and a lot of the tour shows, and, you know, consulting on a lot of things that came along, and pitching story, and then being at the lot too and pitching stories and working on the original StarTrek.com when it opened up, when they actually had a news team in LA, and it was, we'd do chats with the actors when they walked over from the stages, and just a lot of that kind of thing. And I went in a lot. I knew the archive for a while better than anybody else in licensing for probably 10-15 years. So yeah, just a lot of stuff when everything was crazy busy, the 90s and the aughts, and then the great shutdown in 05 when it wasn't just Star Trek going off the air, but Decipher Game Company kind of went belly up almost, and that was the game, that was the official magazine and fan club, and the big Viacom divorce and CBS and Paramount split, and they fought over who got custody of Star Trek, and it went to the TV mom, and Motion Picture Dad takes it out, you know, for a special trip every 3 or 4 years, and the rest of the time divorced mom CBS ignores it. So
that's a shame. Like, we had a whole episode where we just like complained that Star Trek was ripped apart and that no one's really doing anything with it right now but the fans.
Yeah, I mean, other than the movies themselves.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's like one of
it's
like
kind of like I used to talk about like the fallow 80s when Star Trek was all about getting well, the 70s was like just getting it revived, and then it was like, well, that made sense as a movie because the cast was too old to be doing TV and they wouldn't want to do it. And then finally the brainchild idea of not recasting them but going ahead 80 years, well, suddenly Star Trek was not about Kirk, Spock, and McCoy. It was about this whole concept and this whole universe, and you could go to this corner of it and tell your stories, or this time, or back in time, or forward. And, you know, and when it became that, a 3D chess game of Star Trek, then that was, you know, it took was cool, and then we're back in that same thing here.
Yeah, it took a totally different dimension right there, because it's funny because I'm older than Dave and Faith, and I do remember, I was young during that time period, but the period between the original series and Next Gen, when those two came, there was just there's like a fanzines and like you said, those technical manuals, and there was just like, you know, the letter sections in the fanzines of people arguing back and forth, and it would take a month or so for the response to that person or whatever. It's like Facebook, but on like very slow motion.
Snail Facebook.
Yeah, and it's just hard to explain, but
Are you talking about Interstate?
Yeah, all those type of things, you know, those.
Yeah, and it felt like that was a rush. It was like, damn it, I just wrote this letter last month. Now I got to like answer them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, it was. And I was very young at the time, but I used to, you know, I'd go to the, you know, to the stores or whatever, and I'd ask my mom to buy things. She's like, why do you want to buy that? You know, it's like, but I was so into it, and I wanted to find out all the little things. And it wasn't just Star Trek. I mean, it was all this culture out there, for Star Wars to everything else, but it was just a different era. And it's so fascinating that, you know, you have that angle that, you know, because I was young, but you have the angle because you were involved with that more, because I wasn't writing any letters because I was too young for that at the time, but I was just eating it all up because there was nowhere else to look.
Only seven.
What? Yeah. No, but
you're precocious.
But you know what I mean. Yeah. You know, it's like it was like one of those times where it's like there was nowhere else to look to it except the fans. And it was like I was saying to Dave earlier, I just feel like you have these fandom, like you were saying, expanses where nothing's happening. It's the fans that are keeping it alive. And I feel like this is like one of the times again with Star Trek, you know. We're waiting for, you know, the companies and the people with the property rights to start reviving things. So, but yeah, it's a different time.
Yeah, and speaking of like the fandom stuff, you know, Larry, if you've not seen Star Trek Continues,
it started in, you know, 1970 or 71.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I'm just saying it was a different time. So, but Dave was just saying that to the fandom stars that because you've been involved with the Star Trek Continues.
Yeah, for the first two episodes, playing Mr. Leonard McCoy.
Yeah. Yeah.
How was that?
Doctor.
Doctor, sorry, not Mr.
Leonard McCoy, MD.
There you go. Leonard Horatio McCoy, MD.
Possibly divorced.
Yeah, and I'm very complete. In fact, I was solving a puzzle last week. I'm still a creative consultant, which they have a big enough think tank, you know, brain trust on the thing anyway. But I still get calls from frantic people, either with dealing with the internet and CBS and stuff, or at times, or but mostly like with story things. Like, oh, what about this or this, or oh no, we just found out, or somebody just realized this, giving notes on the script. So that's been a lot of fun and really something that's taken off. But yeah, it's like the fan films today are like, I mean, there's still fan fiction and all that, but the good old, you know, the technology in the 70s. You know, the mindset was, damn it, they took this away from us, and we're not going to let it die. And we're not just not going to let it die. We're going to keep making our own. So there, because, damn it, I wanted in my life. In the 70s, that meant fanzines and, you know, and costuming and stuff a little bit, too. But now it's like you can do a movie on a laptop. So now keeping it alive or just – it's like keeping it alive sounds noble. It's just – people are just selfish. They just want their damn Star Trek.
Yeah.
You know? And if you're not going to give it to me out of Hollywood, then I'll make my own. Thank you very much.
Right.
You
know? And it's just,
and you can do that now.
Yeah, so, it's, but, you know, that's the cool thing. I mean, like, because, you know, go back to the 70s, it was like all fanzines. Now people are making their own shows and they're making their own small movies and what have you. So it is more exciting than probably the 70s, but.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, people built models. People did blueprinting. People did, you know, people did costumes. People did conventions and stuff. They did more than just fanzines, but I mean, as far as something with a scope to it, that was kind of, and people actually, there were a few people who would sit down with, you know, like the Yorktown, the original Yorktown movie that's getting finished now, started as a, you know, whatever, 16 millimeter movie on film that people tried. You know, there were fan films then. There was one that was in a magazine that they showed how they did the blockheaded aliens. I've forgotten it now, but there were a few people who were really ambitious, and they were either just – they grew up with film, you know, next to them or something. But they actually tried to do a couple of movies in the 70s and 80s. But yeah, the easiest thing for most people to access was, you know, fan fiction and zine writing, or else backgrounding and doing blueprints and ship charts and, you know, and then the early gaming, like paper and dice gaming, you know,
yeah.
Starfleet Battles and the first, you know, in the 80s, was the first FASA role play or FASA role play gaming and all that, and the guy before them actually.
Yeah.
The first had little metal ships and little metal figurines.
Yeah.
But, you know, but again, that people were, it's like, well, if you're not going to give it to me, I'll make it myself. F you very much, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's the same way. I mean, that's how we were. I mean, I was growing up. So it's cool hearing it from another angle, because I was a very one sided, my experience very myopic, because I was only, you know, 10 years old or whatever. So I was, you know, it was a different time for me.
And well, right now, you are in Houston, the lovely rainy Houston, or no, you're somewhere in Texas. Are you in Houston?
Yeah, it's a little less rainy than it was a few days ago, so, but yeah.
And you're working on the your kind of Wrath documentary. How has that been going?
It's been going good. It's been a different time because my cameraman couldn't come with me this trip, so Neil Halford, so this has been a little off a little off kilter. I guess it matches the background here, but but it's been going well. We got like 3 or 4 people in a day. It's been like one day. The first time we've been to Houston, it's been off and on. We worked on this 4 or 5 years. It wasn't ever going to be like a rush, or, you know, like a get it done in 9 months kind of thing. So this has been like a weekend shade tree kind of project, but it's wrapping up now. And if people are like, some people have been hearing me talk about this since like 2011, and they're like, what the hell are you going to finish that damn thing? So it's like Rod Roddenberry told me, he's like, just don't take 8 years. Like Trek Nation took 8 years to finally get finished.
But so, Trek Nation looked like it needed that amount of time for it to kind of happen, though. I mean, I imagine it was a pain working on it for 8 years, but it just the breadth of that documentary seemed like it really needed that much time.
Time to breathe.
To be what it was.
Right.
You're talking about Trek Nation. That was kind of Rod kind of – it was a very personal thing for him, trying to figure out what it was going to be at first. So, and then the last 3 or 4 years, he kept going through editors that weren't quite giving him what he wanted. So it was just a case of, yeah, finding it. But in my case, I had the idea to do this. Well, I've told the story many times, but I mean, it was like my first road trip as a kid to be at the Ultimate Fantasy show, which was like a huge first time the cast was all going to be together, not just at a convention back when conventions were – Trek conventions had only been about 10 years old. And, you know, Star Trek invented – you know, you look at Comic-Con San Diego or any of the big media things. Star Trek wrote the book on that. I mean, Star Trek fans – came up with the Well Committee to be an internet before the internet was invented, only we did it all with stamps. and, you know, snail mail. I mean, we were talking a minute ago about, you know, what you could do and didn't do. People had that itch to do this stuff, and hell, if the technology wasn't there, they'd just invent it. But, you know, Star Trek, the whole thing with actor, you know, because sci-fi cons had been around since the world cons in the 30s, but the fact that a TV show, you know, not a rock band, not a, you know, movie stars, they'd had fan clubs and things, but the fact that this TV show or this thing could have this kind of devotion was just kind of amazing, and it just kind of broke the, you know, pop culture, and then made that be invented. The joke about porn and Star Trek built the internet. That's but so Conrath, we're trying to wrap it up this year, and it was about this event that really happened in Houston in June of 82. So anyway, so we're here in Houston. I'm kind of bringing in for a landing. Was going to be our last trip to Houston proper, since this was ground zero. This is where the Conrath, aka the Ultimate Fantasy, actually happened. But we made a trip after this. But I still had people coming up with stuff. I had a guy show me a little fanzine that people had written about a month or two later that had all this detail, you know, snarky fans writing about what they just survived and loving it. And it was just a lot of detail even in that. But it was, and again, it was somebody else in 82 that wrote a thing that said, I survived the Conrath back then. So it kind of, you know, makes it relevant. But then again, somebody who found it through Star Trek Continues, who saw me post on the Continues site about Conrath, and she had been there and had no idea that it was – she loved the show and had no idea it was deemed a failure or that it was deemed a meltdown or whatever. And she got a hold of me just in July, and she lives about 2 hours away and came in. So it's – you know, you could go on forever and still keep finding people, but we're – kind of wrapping it up. But right, since we've gotten George and Walter and Nichelle and Wendy Doohan and Laura Banks, the colleague who pushed the button and shot Spock,
yeah,
the Enterprise, we've got a lot of the name people, and Hart Bennett, you know, a few years before he passed away. So all the people on the crew, and then the dealers, and then the fans, survivors from around the country, wherever they are. There's probably 30, 40 people on camera so far, so I don't need to add a lot more. I'm just kind of looking for a few quality stories. But we're trying to bring it home in the next 12 to 18 months.
That's great. You're going to have that much depth and that many interviews. What is your plans after everything's edited? How do you plan to release that?
Well, that's a good question. I've got like four or five claims on Premiere, so we'll have to see how that goes. Between the big conventions and Houston and me back home in Oklahoma and a few other places, we may have some like slices of the Premiere pie going to different places.
Uh-huh.
And then I'm not really sure. I want to do some festivals. Not really sure. Like, there's a lot of room for a documentary now. And this is my first media documentary thing to do, so I'm learning a lot and, you know, consulting smart people. But you know, eventually DVDs, but I just would, you know, Netflix is out there. Because I want this to be something more than just something for the con circuit, because I want to talk about a little bit of human nature and kids in their 20s who are ambitious and can handle things, and when things happen to you that you're not expecting, and just talk about, like, life, you know, like fandom in the 80s versus now. Like, a lot of stuff is the same, exact, all the same passions are there, but in the 80s they didn't have the internet, they didn't have cell phones.
Yeah.
So, you know, just... which contributes to the plot of the whole thing a little bit. So we talk about, and I just laugh at all the, you know, the geek girl revolution of the last 3 or 4 years when, you know, Star Trek fandom got out of the gate because of female fans. So I think all that went skewy with the Shatner skit on Saturday Night Live in 86. When
right.
Everybody in the audience at the convention was like the snot-nosed boys in T-shirts. I'm like, where are all the women?
Yeah.
Where's all the
yeah.
Spock and Vulcan fans? We're doing all those zines. Anyway, I think that's kind of skewed. So there's all the women on camera. You know, oh, my God, there were girls in fandom in the 80s, early 80s? Yes.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's just – so we have a lot of fun with some sidebars as well as just the main thrust of the story. So I'm hoping it's a lot of human interest as well as just the Star Trek story, and that it'll have some have some interest beyond just the con circuit. So we'll see.
Yeah,
I've got a lot of ambitions for it. Have to deliver on that someday.
That no, it sounds great because it's so interesting because there's so many young fans out there, or people who are around just when the internet was really starting to take off, and now they don't have like a good concept of of what life was like you're saying, you know, through snail mail, having
letter writing campaigns, all that stuff,
or even, you know, having a couple quarters to make a phone call in a phone booth somewhere because you needed to make a call somewhere. You know, it's just it seems bizarre now. It's even like, because I got young kids at home, and they don't even that world will never be part of their world. So it's
telephone booths don't exist anymore. Superman has no more places to change.
Yeah, exactly.
Like the TARDIS. Well, I was reading this one that I had just gotten, and she was talking about they got up at 7 a.m. to make a long distance call before the rates went back up, and I'd totally forgotten about that.
Yeah,
yeah.
And that's another thing is, like, you know, like, I think about when you used to have to pay for long distance calls, and it's so bizarre now you're talking about it. It's like that was a thing.
Everything's just minutes now. Yeah, minutes.
Yeah. Yeah. Carbon paper. What's that?
Yeah.
Paper.
Yeah.
Right. That's too analog for me.
On your email, but what did that really mean? Yeah.
Yeah.
Dot matrix printers.
We were also hoping that you could kind of talk about your other project that you have, Enterprise and Space, if you could talk just a little bit about that as well, because that's very interesting.
Yeah, Enterprise and Space is a nonprofit brainchild of a fan in Oregon who didn't stop until he wound up getting all these great names and a superstar lineup of people from education and, like, NASA, you know, contractors or retirees or whatever. But basically, it started with the idea that he was watching Next Generation one day and thought, it's too bad there'd never been a real Enterprise flight in space, because the shuttle, you know, was a test dropship. In fact, a lot of people, since, after the whole mail campaign to name the first shuttle Enterprise, some people, you know, kind of in a retro way, have gone, well, that was stupid. Why didn't you wait to get one that actually flew instead of just the test ship?
Yeah.
At the time, it was going to be actually a flyer, you know.
Well, too bad it wasn't
anyway,
the NX.
Out of that. That was the NX.
Yeah, let's get the real USS Enterprise in space, right?
Yeah, well, it's the NSS because the National Space Society, which is like one of the two, like Planetary Society and National Space Society, and they've adopted it as a project, but this is a big nonprofit to basically put 100 or more student preschool to grad school science, engineering, technology, math, arts, experiments, projects, whatever, into orbit. And that's nothing new. That's been done. But these would all be global and in the STEAM, you know, not just science-y things, but STEAM across the board. Flying on an orbiter for a week or more, 5 years down the road, just for the timetables. But the craft would be called the Enterprise. It would be the first Enterprise to fly. And it would basically built on not just the name, but all the ideals of Star Trek and all the ideals of futuristic, hopeful science fiction, not just Gene and Star Trek, but, you know, Asimov and Heinlein and all that. And just that the idea of getting into the future and the idea of, like, the early days, like the Gemini and Apollo and Mercury launches and the shuttles even now. The shuttle is even like this sentimental thing. But when people would get excited and drop everything and run in and watch a launch and bringing that kind of excitement back, because eventually we're kind of getting into that now with talk about going to Mars and all. And some of the movies the last two or three, Interstellar and Gravity and now The Martian especially,
yeah,
kind of getting that feel back. Since we're not getting it in real life, but we're kind of getting there. So this team is put together, the education side for the rollout to schools and students and teachers in the public worldwide, and the engineering side to fabricate this after we had a contest to design it. All the space technologists, like the private sector emerging space companies from SpaceX on down, who have jumped into basically there's been – the budget is $40 million, and there's been $26 million in-kind promised, which has actually also bumped the budget up. But there's a crowdfunding element to it, and we're also going for big grants from some of the related, like, foundations and things that do that. But the crowdfunding side is also kind of a grassrootsy reflection of – there's not a Kickstarter or Indiegogo because it's going to go on for 4 or 5 years, and they're going to gradually add some perks to it. But right now it's just a simple – hey, if 2 million people give $20 worldwide, we have it, you know,
yeah,
or more.
Yeah.
And if you do that, not only are you get your little printout, you're in the virtual crew, but your name goes on a chip that will fly at the very least. And when it comes back and goes on tour, because it will re-enter and all the experiments will come back, they'll take the craft on tour to conventions and science museums, and it'll go in a permanent location and they're talking to the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum as the first one. But when all that happens, when you put in your $20 or more, you get your little certificate. But the other thing is you know that you were in the virtual crew of the first Enterprise in space.
That's great.
That's awesome.
That's cool. Wow. That's cool.
Yeah.
So you're...
it's part of the little appeal. So enterpriseinspace.org, you can go right over. Anybody listening to this right now can go over and do that. And, you know, $20, that's, you know, like
just nothing.
Somebody said that's two lattes in a month or whatever for
yeah,
somebody.
I mean, right,
you know.
Yeah.
And you're in, and you can give them as gifts. And it, in the States, anyway, it's tax deductible, so you can even take it off if you deduct if you take deductions, you can take the 20 or whatever, 40 or 100 or whatever you want to put in, but yeah, you're included. And then later on, we are about to roll out some more perks, because the idea was just to keep it simple, and this has been kind of a slow rolling launch, so because it's been a real bootstraps kind of thing too.
Right.
But the two-time Educator of the Year for NASA is the head of the Education Department, Lynn, and Fred Becker, who is an engineer that worked on NASA projects from the late shuttles – or the late – from Skylab all the way through. The last thing he worked on was Pluto New Horizons. It just got to Pluto.
Yeah.
So he's our chief engineer. There's a whole raft of Sean Case is the guy in Oregon who dreamed this up, who still stays on as the founder. Alice Hoffman is the project manager who oversaw like the $8 billion expansion of Soldier Field in Chicago and O'Hare Airport, and has overseen big money projects like that. And we've had partners come in that want to partner, and there's one called eMind, Enterprise Mind, from a group called ValueSpring that's working on a talking cognitive computer that's kind of like way closer to, you know, the Elcar's Majel system on the Enterprise than to like Siri or Watson or something.
Wow.
Nice.
So, well, way beyond Siri, but, you know, even beyond Watson, interactive with people so that the controllers as a demo, as some of these other companies are, as a demo for something they're going to turn around and want to do, contract with or build on their own. So, so a lot of people have been finding this project out as a way to come aboard. So, so we're looking for some of the larger grant monies, but there's still plenty of room for our virtual crew to come aboard and fly. And eventually, we're looking at seriously adding like a tablet that would deploy and tether out, or a camera that would deploy out, and have a tablet mounted in a portal. And again, you can go to enterpriseinspace.org and see all this, and see the designs, and see everything. But have it where if you have a little higher donation, your picture is on, and you can wave out the window and have a picture of you waving from the first Enterprise.
Oh, that would be sweet.
That's awesome. Oh, that's great.
Everybody just jump over. And, you know, there's a Facebook page. There's an Enterprise in Space Facebook page, and Enterprise Sat is the Twitter. So, they had been going on this 4 or 5 years, came to me about a year and a half ago, about being on their advisory board, and then a little bit later saying, well, would you just be on our team and be kind of our lead spokesman, and we were still ramping it up, but so I've been talking to some of the celebrities about doing endorsements, and, you know, Buzz Aldrin and Nichelle and Grace Lee before she passed away, and Walter and Chris Doohan, and and Vic and Michelle from Star Trek Continues, and Manu and Arani, and we just barely started scratching the surface of the celebrity endorsements, but they kind of lead off with Buzz Aldrin on down.
Wow.
And so that's been good to go. They're on the page too. And you know, aside from money, we need volunteers all the way from professional skills down to I will take flyers to the local con or the local teacher conference or whatever in my, you know, my area. So
wow,
we need everybody to help out.
That's awesome. So that's great. There's, it seems like it's opening the gateway to young people too, to have, you know, more interest in space and science and just the whole field, because like you're saying, like now we're seeing more of that lately, but there was like, it seemed like a dry spell for a very long time of space exploration.
I'm glad it's starting to come back. It really needs to, and definitely need to get the kids and everything interested in science and math and everything so that we can make stuff happen for real.
Yeah, because they're not going
to... Yeah, and the scope of the thing, and they take a lot of pains to say it's not... They talk about STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. It's running lately to a team with an A for the arts, so that they're... Because of their impact, and actually having like arts projects be in the payload,
right?
Like space art and space music and some interesting things. And Lynn Zielinski, who I mentioned, she's overseen student projects on shuttles and on, like, you know, ground launched things. One thing is the students that would, like, you go through some contest and get chosen to be aboard, but then you had to pay your own way. You had to pay the space for your thing aboard and your, you know, your little whatever package it was. And if you wanted to go through the launch yourself, or you wanted to, you know, whatever, you had to pay your own way. And one of the things in our budget is the 100 plus winners of this aren't paying their, you know, their it's like, well, the good news is you won. The bad news is you won and you have to pay for it. Well, this is all going to be just good news. Plus, we're going to pay their way to come and load up their projects when we're loading up the capsule or the orbiter, and then have them there to see the launch. And not just, again, not just American, but they're trying to reach as far as practical, you know, Europe, India, China, any Africa, wherever, not even presupposing, you know, who's got a more advanced average culture, but trying to reach out. Because one of the things that the eMind concept is, one of their things they want to do is have a palm-sized tutor in the hand of every kid in the world, no matter where they are. Like, imagine what you could do for the economics of all countries in the world, no matter what their politics or their resources are.
Yeah, it would be amazing.
Yeah, that is a really good idea.
Where and what that would do. So that's kind of a big out-of-the-box, kind of what Rod Roddenberry and their foundation calls a paradigm-shifting thing. So, and but there's a lot of other partners that are pledging support, you know, either huge discounts or totally like a new launching technology that's volunteering to launch for free just in return for being part of the publicity and the team and everything. So, but it is made. So enterpriseandspace.org, and it's just now cranking up with a lot of information on, like I said, the engineering of it and the education side of it, and we still need volunteers in our social media and everything.
That's great.
That sounds fantastic.
Anybody out there enjoys that, just go and click on the volunteers tab at Enterprise. After you make your $20 virtual crew membership,
right?
Yeah,
come over and do that. It'll be awesome. And again, it won't fly until 2019. The current schedule is like a 5 years out thing. And I know that's, we've been into it for a year. That's the hope for schedule, because they have the education outreach for taking in submissions for projects to be aboard is like going to be in three waves a year apart. Okay. And then that also lets the engine, because they're going to probably 3D fabricate it. And a company called SpaceWorks is going to do the plans. And then we've got two or three partners that are looking to actually build it. And it would probably be a secondary payload on a booster that goes up. So it's not having to be, cause the whole cost itself.
And why don't we talk about Portal 47 then?
Thanks for asking about Portal 47. So all these years of like magazine writing and books and doing interviews, me interviewing people and people interviewing me on all these projects, I just had a whole lot of assets. Now as the years are going by and tech is bringing us new channels, ways of doing things, and we've got so many new fans and we've got so many fans that have been around that maybe even being bored, or it's just the same old, and people are all, like you guys, people are trying to bring new ways of doing things in. And I just know that aside from the new fans and the old fans, there are fans that don't even know what's still out there, because it's not quite like knowing where the skeletons are buried, but I know where there's a lot of assets buried in my office because I've got over 500-600 hours of like interview tape, like long form interviews, and I've been bringing them out on my CDs every year. Like one a Trekland on speaker that I debut at Vegas with a theme, but even that is like slow drip drip. So the last few years I've been trying to figure out some new way to use, you know, the latest of the 21st century and find a new way to get backstage in the 24th century. So Portal 47, which I hope you guys know the legend of the 47 there, or the story of the 47.
Yeah, 47, right? Just pops up a whole lot in species.
Well,
84762.
Yeah. Well, there's a whole lot more. It started at a college, and Joe Manosky brought it to Next Generation, then it spread. So it's not even originally a Star Trek thing, but Star Trek's probably the most famous example of it now. But 47 is the most common random number in the universe.
Huh. Is that right?
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
According to this bored math professor one summer at Pomona College with a class of statistics kids in the summer, as a classroom exercise. Now, you can actually read about it. But that was where I got the name Portal. But it's a portal as in a gateway. So what Portal 47 is the whole bundle of a lot of new ways to get backstage in a kind of a deep dive way But it's me using my archives that I've got set back and my own personal memories and a lot of the Rolodex of people that worked on the shows, people that aren't going to be turning up at a convention anytime soon, and may or may not have even been interviewed at some time or another. I'm going to have – I'll have some big names too, but we're using like not Skype here but like teleconferencing to get a lot of people on a call at once with somebody. So I do that a couple of times a month. I do a call just with me. We have – I've got pieces coming, some like images and audio and documents coming out of my archives that go to the portales, whatever I call them. and then there's some – since the idea is for it to be, you know, internet-based, so it's global, the only limitations are time zones and sometimes geography. So the people in Europe, I'm trying to start an afternoon telebriefing as well for the Germans and the Brits and the fans over there. But on the live side, whenever there's a large con, like Vegas or San Diego or anything, anywhere where there's a person that's nearby, I will have a Portal 47 meetup. And if they're ever in L.A., I work with Terrace Cassidy and Geeks Nation Tours, and every 2 years we have a big L.A. to Vegas Trek Film Sites tour with me in the title. And we're going to add San Francisco to that next year for the 50th. But just as a tour, if people come to L.A., I'm going to have a menu of tour choices, and people can like pick out four. And I'm going to start offering that. And then if you're a Portal 47 person, that would be like half price or something. But there's nice. You go to Portal47.net. There's a whole package of the things monthly. So it's a monthly subscription. It's $25 a month. So for the cost of two movie tickets a month, we're having all this access to hopefully a lot of people have not heard from, with a lot of good stories. People can pick my brain on whatever they want to. We're getting out some more, you know, stuck away, hidden, wacky or interesting documents and images and audio pieces, audio interviews or mainly interviews that have never been out there before. And people are driving the direction of a lot of that. They're, you know, people are feedbacking to me about what they want to do. And there's a Facebook community that's just the closed community. So there's the public Facebook 47, and then once you're in, we have a group community that, you know, interfaces and talks. So it's just – I've just been trying for years to figure out something new that gets more of this stuff that's buried away out to people in a faster way than waiting on books to come along or even the little drips and drabs you get, you know, online. And a way that, like, lets me still keep putting food on the table.
Right.
Which is helpful.
Right.
Yeah, which is good.
Exactly. You
know. And part of it is also, like, I've got, like, six or eight boxes of these tapes, and doing my CD every year is not pushing me along to get more of these analog cassette tapes digitized and out. And this would be one way of accelerating that a little bit, too. So.
Right, because you see.
So I'm really excited. I've had an entrepreneur coach helping me put this together the last few months, and we finally launched in September. So we're only in the third month, and people can come aboard anytime. So
cool.
If you go over, I need to put up a snazzy little video, but for right now, just at portal47.net, it's all laid out there, and you know, everybody jump aboard. And we've got some fun people already in the group, but so far we've talked to Mike Demerit and Dave Trotty, who were first assistant ADs, who have tons of stories. One of the major stand-ins and stunt guys, Richard Sarstedt, who when he was younger was a singer, a teenage pop star in England when he was like a teenager. Wow. But he wound up being – he was a stand-in for Jonathan and then Robert Beltran and then Bud Scott on Enterprise. Wow. He was like with from day one all 18 years of modern TV Star Trek and was on camera a lot and had some great stories to talk about. In fact, we barely scratched the surface. So, I have more people coming lining up too on that. Oh, and the thing is, whenever we do one of those, we have recordings, and then you get your recording when it's over. So,
well, that's cool.
That's awesome.
Yeah, because I was going to say.
So, hopefully, it's a little bit out of the box, and you know, the subject matter is out of the box, the delivery is out of the box, a little something different, and we'll see how it goes. And then later on down the line, I've got some more plans as soon as this, you know, takes off big time. So, I'm just really excited to finally get this going. A lot of work involved in kind of inventing some of this stuff, but it's really exciting kind of doing something different.
It does sound like a lot of work, and all these things you're involved with, you just sound so busy with everything. But it's really great, the work that you do that's inspiring and you know, great for Star Trek fans and, you know, just anyone in general, especially with that Project Enterprise that you have going on.
Yeah, it's cool. And I was saying before is like, especially when you're talking about the Portal 47, is that, you know, you're got your hand in so many different of the, you know, different parts of Star Trek over the years. So just your background knowledge of just the behind the scenes stuff, it just got to be insane. You know what, like you said, your archives and all the other information that you just have probably, you know, put away that probably almost be trivial to you, but then to like some, you know, guys like us, it would be like whoa, that's cool. I didn't know that. You know, just weird stuff. You know, yeah, it's definitely a cool idea. So can't wait to.
Well, that was, I kind of had to go through a head thing because when everything kind of blew up in 05, I mean, I knew that like the magazine could have gone. I mean, I knew we had plenty of stuff to get out there for people. But when the landscape blew up and when suddenly, you know, the Star Trek was CBS's property, but CBS didn't have anything to deal with legacy. I mean, like there was no licensing at CBS. They had to staff up a department and they're. The online.com got shut down a couple of years later, and it went to CBS's Interactive. And after two or three changeovers, nobody there knew why they had this dead show when their whole purpose was to promote primetime, you know, the new shows. And they didn't really even now they are getting there. But I mean, there wasn't an ILoveLucy.com, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, like the legacy shows, that wasn't in their radar. They've gotten there now, and the website has come back as a thing of licensing, not as part of, you know, Interactive, but. There for 4, 5, 6 years, everything just blew up, and nobody in all the people who had run Star Trek, either under the studio or all the major players from licensees and people who had, you know, done work like me, all that blew up, and there were only 4 or 5 bodies standing, and people and all the new things didn't exist. And then when they did exist, people didn't know each other, and nobody had a history, and nobody, a lot of people had worked in merchandising and licensing and audience things, and, you know, but they didn't know Star Trek.
Right.
And they didn't know how the Star Trek audience was different from things. So there for 4, 5, 6 years, it was just wacky. And I started going to cons and realized, you know, and I was like, what am I going to do? I can't talk about the new shows coming out in the back. You know, oh, here's the sketches of the Zindi CGI guy. That was gone. And I realized at one point, one show, I was in Dallas, I think, and I forgot my newest slides to put in my show. And I'm like, well, I've got nothing to do. And I thought, well, people were still kind of like clinging, walking in the wilderness about, oh, this JJ movie, or okay, well, that was okay, but what now? And I'm like, well, maybe we should talk about like how, you know, how the business and how the media and how Star Trek and a lot of this stuff is really going on. And I started talking at cons about not just pure Star Trek background, but here's kind of, I started calling it the state of the Trek or the state of the franchise, and like throwing out some points for people that maybe they hadn't thought about. And people, oh, okay. You know, like, we're mad at the movie cast. They're not coming to cons. It's like, well, yeah, they're movie actors because it's not a show and it's a different thing.
Yeah.
Like, oh, okay. And I realized I could share that with people and it might, you know. So there was a point when I went, oh, great. All this stuff I have is all moldy oldy. It's all the old stories. No one cares anymore. Everybody knows this stuff. We've got actually had this living, breathing fandom that's turning over and gaining new people from all these different reasons. And people don't know all this stuff already. And they don't just automatically know the stuff that, you know, we said. And people didn't even, you know, now we're in a time when people don't know what it was like to have a show come out every week. I mean, they're just, everything is just, you know, row of Netflix icons. There is just a row of DVD boxes, you know, on the shelf. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, so I figured out, yeah, I guess there's a reason to hang around and not chunk everything.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I just wanted to bring up, I wonder if you could elaborate a little bit, like you were saying, like in 2005 and, you know, when Enterprise, you know, kind of like hit against the rocks and it just all went away. Do you have any insight on all that other than just the studio? Just because the one thing that, you know, as a fan that infuriated me is that they wanted to cancel Enterprise.
Just getting perfect.
It was getting great. And then the fans all wanted to, they were actually, this was before, you know, Kickstarter and Indiegogo, they wanted to fund it. They were wanting to put money forward and they were still like, nah, I don't think so.
Well, in Trek Nation, Rod Roddenberry came out and signed the giant petition sign they had as they were picketing the lot. Like,
what could you like? Just, I'm sure you have a little more background. I mean, obviously, you don't want to say anything; it doesn't need to be said.
No,
but
that was the guy. Yeah, no, that was an interesting time. Yeah, I thought about that because at the time, there was a guy named Tim Brazeal who just wanted to have a petition drive online. This is 04, 05. Well, for one thing, the writing on the wall had been that UPN was a stupid little network the whole time, from Voyager onward. with that kept turning over every 2 or 3 years and had little people thinking they were running a network. And it was sad because the WB and UPN launched the same time, and the WB was still small, but they kind of had a plan and grew and had a strategy and had an identity after a while.
Yeah.
And UPN was like, oh, we've got Star Trek and Voyager's our flagship. And they had some good shows, but they didn't like nurse things along, and they didn't stick with anything. And they, you know, Star Trek was the golden cow or the golden calf, and nothing else survived. They were either horrible shows like Platypus Man or something, or they were not bad shows like 7 Days. There you go. Who remembered Platypus? Who cared?
All the platypuses, they cared.
They remembered.
The platypi, I'm sorry.
Talk in the plural.
So after like 5, 6, 7 years, finally, like Les Moonves at CBS, they owned half of it, or they just said, oh, good grief, guys, if you can't run this like a real network, just leave and get out of here. And that's when they started thinking about, you know, combining UPN and WB into, what is it now, the
CW,
right. So they took over and just started running it. And when that did, everything changed. Like 2 years into Enterprise, that's when they said, okay, sorry, Star Trek, sorry, Enterprise, you're not the golden child anymore. You're not the hands-off thing. You have to start living like the rest of the world does. And if you have crappy ratings, then you need to go,
and,
you know.
And did it have crappy ratings?
And
because I don't remember having crappy ratings.
Was UPN was always a crippled network. Well, okay, here's the thing. You would look at the top 100 for the week, and on one hand, you would say, well, Enterprise is a top-rated show on UPN, but the UPN shows would all like be in the 80s and 90s. Like, here's your number one show, you can show, and Enterprise would always be like, whatever. Now, the thing was, UPN was such a crippled little network, they didn't even have 100% penetration in the whole country, and when they did, they would be on channels that would, like, show the, you know, Buffalo, did you guys have Enterprise and Voyager when it was scheduled? I mean, there were a lot of those. Here's the national airtime, but if there was a local, you know, basketball or hockey game and that station had the contract, it would get bumped to 2 a.m, and that happened on a lot of stations.
It didn't happen in Buffalo.
It happened here.
It did happen with UPN.
I didn't live in Buffalo.
It happened here a lot. I had to pick up Voyager about 1 o'clock in the morning.
Oh god!
Yeah,
all the reruns and that, it was ridiculous. But I would set it to record. I was loyal.
Well, like with me, I lived in Louisiana at the time, and then I lived in Arkansas. I guess Louisiana for Voyager, then Arkansas for Mississippi for Enterprise, and we had to like disconnect the cable and put up an antenna to try to find UPN to watch Voyager and to watch Enterprise.
That's pretty fancy.
Because it wasn't never came through the cable line. We had to like put up an antenna to
the old rabbit
to find Star Trek. Yeah,
that's bizarre.
Just for the next hour. Don't move.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Did you have to climb the phone pole and call Sarah to have... Yeah.
Hey, Sarah! Put on the UPN!
We need that UPN Star Trek stuff. Come on.
Yeah, a little to the left. You're almost there. Okay.
They had the old wheel thing when they...
Yeah, it was
Green Acres joke there.
Yeah, no, I know what you're going for there. Yeah.
One of us is old enough for it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. All right, stop it, guys.
Faith and I like making old jokes at Aaron.
Yeah.
Well, I thought I'd take the relief off of you.
Thank you. Thank
Larry
you.
Nemechek has saved us again.
He's probably only 10 years older than me.
Yeah, don't you forget it. the great irony of that is when Enterprise was getting bashed for the rate, and then the ratings had slowly been going down anyway because they realized that instead of like cream of the crop, they had DS9 and Voyager were like splitting the audience and people were like going one or the other.
Yeah.
And some people still watch both like I did, but then I had to. I mean, I don't mean...
Held a gunpoint.
I had a gun to my head, but I needed to. But a lot of people either went down the DS9 or all of it was like going down over the years. And then Enterprise had a big blip. And the audiences were all a little different. I mean, Enterprise is really weird. A lot of the TNG people who got mad, I mean, a lot of the original series people who got mad at TNG and wouldn't watch it back in 87, like, you know, 10% of the world or whatever, the fandom, came back out of the woodwork and started watching Enterprise. It was really weird. There were all these like original series fans that had never watched the newer stuff, but after, they came back because this was supposed to lead into Kirk and Spock and McCoy, and so they did. But the ratings still kept going down. Part of that was because UPN was a wacky doodle little network. But still, the numbers, what people, there were still like, I don't know how many million people watching a week, but at the same time, the last year of Enterprise overlapped with the first year of Ron Moore's, you know, rebooted Battlestar Galactica, which was such a darling in the sci-fi world and in the TV world. And it was such a hit and such a, you know, buzzy mentioned thing. And what's wacky is it was a big fish in the small pond of, like, the cable. It was on sci-fi, you know, like USA and TBS and those guys. And a lot of that stuff was happening with the one-hour, you know, quirky dramas when the networks were going over to reality shows and seven. A lot of the really interesting dramas were starting to move to the cable networks, and then even, you know, Sopranos, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, on the premium shows. And Battlestar had all this buzz, but just by sheer numbers, when Enterprise was in its last year trying to hang on, and it was really on life support because it was really supposed to have been canceled after 3 years, and they bought off a fourth year. The TV studio bought off a year from the network. They brought the budget down, and then they also paid more for it. So they'd have 100 shows at the end to, you know, syndicate and put on DVDs. Mm-hmm. That last year of Enterprise, and it was like at its lowest ebb of viewers, there were still a million more people watching it a week than Battlestar Galactica when it was in its first big boom year.
That's crazy, because, like, I remember all the advertising for Battlestar Galactica, best show on television. They were saying how good it was.
Yeah,
all the time.
I mean, there's a lot of.
It took a couple years to warm up. I was a big Battlestar Galactica fan. The problem is I had, like, a prime right in the middle for, like, 4 years, and then it slacked off.
Well, I mean, I didn't say I didn't like it. I'm just saying, like, it was always, like, the commercials were always, like, highest-rated show on television.
Blew it into, like, this big thing. And, like, honestly, having grown up, like, watching both shows, Star Trek was so much better.
Yeah.
Like, it really just was so much better.
Well, I mean, even though you did have Ronald D. Moore heading, you know, Battlestar Galactica, he was huge in Next Generation and DS9. Yeah.
And I'm not talking about what's better or not better. I'm just talking about the numbers and the perception that it was this huge hit and Enterprise was limping home, you know, crippled little show. But Enterprise, because it was a small fish in a big pond, and Galactica was like a big fish in a small pond.
Yeah.
I guess what I'm saying.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. That makes
a lot more sense.
One, you were still a million ahead a week of being top of the other, but people lose that perception. So
it's sad that that happened to Star Trek.
So you were talking about, so 2005, it goes away, and so that guy, so Tim Brazil in Tennessee starts this campaign to save Enterprise, and they had the protest at the studio, and they had the petition, and all the actors came out and yelled for it, and the writers came out, and it was pretty awesome. We were there covering it, and Rod came and signed that, and then they had a thing at night, and it didn't help, and people didn't bash about, oh, you didn't really have 3 million people. Three anonymous high-level donors pledged a million apiece that couldn't release their name, but that's where, like, the campaign bumped up to 3 million and something. And, of course, people in the industry laughed and said, well, that's barely enough. You know, that's a drop in the bucket of what you'd need. But the symbolic thing was really strong to people. And, yeah, this was before – this was in 05. So this is before Facebook, much less Twitter, and then Kickstarter and all the crowdfunding. You know, crowdfunding was not a word then.
Yeah.
And then they wanted to take that list. They had like 5 million people on their mail list, and they were trying to invent this thing called sci-fi studios where fans and up-and-coming people could collaborate with – cross a couple of filters and collaborate with Hollywood professionals and like jumpstart the middleman and go right into getting content made, and had this whole online world. I mean, this was really – what's sad is this was like a vision that was just ahead of its time. And, you know, just 3 years later, there would be all the Facebook and Twitter and all the social media, Instagram, you know, all that. And then Kickstarter and Indiegogo and all of those guys and GoFundMe would all be there. But they were, like, envisioning this stuff in 04 and 05 and 06 and trying to get it off the ground. And I actually, like, edited a few issues of a PDF magazine. This was going to go, and we were doing it, you know, Sweat Equity, and it was going to fund and go. And there were a couple of producers in Hollywood that were underwriting it. And it was so ambitious and had all these moving parts, and it just was too heavy. After about a year, year and a half of trying to get off the ground, it didn't. But there were some people that had developed some properties to be series and to be features that were going to be like collaborated and funded through this thing, and then they took their stuff, finally took it and went went a couple of different places with it. But I think back on that. That's something that's going to get buried if nobody goes and remembers it. But
it was heavy for me, and I'm a complete outsider. You know, I don't, you know, I would read about it. I would see things on TV and stuff like that. And like you said, you know, the tech was just getting there. It wasn't quite there yet. Mm-hmm. This was a social media. So I think it was like this was the time of MySpace and stuff like that.
Ooh, so, Tom's yeah. my friend.
Yeah, yeah. So all that stuff. But I mean, it was
MySpace
like
MySpace was very hot.
Yes.
There, I think. Yeah. For a long time, you said MySpace and Facebook.
Yeah, well, Tom was my only friend.
Right. Yeah.
Like people that didn't know what either one was say MySpace and Facebook. But yeah, they were about to try to invent all that stuff, it would have been sad because this almost happened to us. We were trying to bring the fan club back when Decipher collapsed and CBS was given the license for Star Trek and all this stuff, and it didn't have a licensing department yet, and there were caretaker attorneys. There were like two people in L.A. left over from the old Paramount division that were now CBS employees because they mainly did Star Trek. And they were the last people standing, and there was nothing else going on. And we were trying to come back with them, and they were all set to do this, but then it didn't happen because we had to wait for a department to get staffed up. And then anyway, we were trying to – it was the same thing. We had this whole thing envisioned because, well, we have to be online now. We can't be paper. We have to be online. Mostly says, but here's all the exciting things we can do. And if we'd actually in 04 and 05 and 06 like funded the building of all this stuff, we would have shot ourselves because like within 2 or 3 years, all this stuff would have been doable via face. Like a ton of it would have been just online stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Definitely. You know, off the shelf. But both of those were cases where people saw stuff coming and we were trying to build it. And out there, and it would have like we would have wasted so much money building where with 3 or 4 years it would have adapted, you know, saved our money and built the really true custom stuff we needed. And but that was a really weird the first four, but even still, it's like I've been, like I said, Portal 47 is me for 10 years going, whoa, what's the new rule book? Because all the old things you used to be like when you used to write for big things, that's all been dynamited. Now everybody wants you to do everything free and cheap and yesterday for the internet, and that's not gonna, you can't raise a family on that,
right?
You know? Yeah. What do you, you know? So this whole thing of inventing how the business model is for people that never worried about a business model before, it's been kind of interesting. It feels like it's finally starting to settle down. But, you know, and anybody who's 2 years old now will just grow up with this. But for a long time, there were a lot of people that were, like, uprooted by, you know, and it all happened together. It's like the internet exploded and Viacom exploded and Star Trek exploded all at the same time. It's like I had this perfect storm in my life of all this stuff. Just kind of, and 06 was like, is anybody still standing? Anybody I know still?
It's like a Michael Bay movie. Everything's blowing up.
I mean, I had plenty of friends. I had plenty of fan friends and plenty of friends. But as far as the way we all kind of like earned our living and made our living, it was all kind of like, okay, what now?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And it's a head scratcher for me. And, you know, you should probably write a book about it, but it's just my opinion.
Well,
what is that? Dead tree? What is that?
Dead tree. Yeah, it's a dead tree. It's a dead tree. It's they put on shelves now. Larry said that he's going to talk about an episode with us. We Faith picked out Mortal Coil from Voyager.
Mortal Coils, and it's a special day because it is actually Faith's birthday today.
Happy birthday, Faith!
And she's droning on. She's sitting there quietly listening to us drone on.
Yeah, I'm soaking in all the knowledge and trying to learn a few things.
But
you can get back at us by just having everybody say Mortal Coil 3 times fast.
Mortal Coil, right. Mortal Coil, Mortal Coil. La la la. La la la.
Twister.
This episode should release on November 1st, so that's really close to Halloween, and this is partially why
the
Faith
released like in 97.
Yeah.
The podcast.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
This thing we're talking, this should release on November 1st, and I believe Faith picked this because it is a Halloweenish tour. I know we did Schisms last week and kind of made that our spooky episode, but I know Faith wanted to speak about this one for...
Yeah, it wasn't just because Neelix was in it and I wanted to torment you guys. There really is a point.
Well, you see, Neelix wasn't originally going to be in this. It was supposed to be, you know, Mrs. Wildman getting killed and then her trying to kill her daughter, and this is a way better story than one about Neelix.
Yeah.
Unfortunately,
well, the whole the whole evolution of this show is kind of. And then there's another stop along. There's another stop along the way with Chakotay in the middle of it.
That's almost as bad as Neelix being the main character of the episode.
Well, yeah. So just a quick rundown. So Neelix is put onto the shuttle. He gets
at gunpoint. He's forced.
No. There's an accident with trying to collect some proto matter, and he is killed, and when they bring him back, it's been like 18 hours.
Apparently the shuttle doesn't go very fast.
It's the slowest shuttle, and they bring him into it, and 7-9 knows a way to revive him. And when they do revive him, they're using Borg technology through nanobots to bring him back. And then he has sort of this crisis of faith because he didn't see his sister. He didn't go to the Great Forest where Talaxians believe that they go after they die.
And he didn't see anyone who ever loved him, so maybe no one loved him, and that's why... That's why he saw nothing.
Right.
Oh, Faith should have been there. She loves him.
She loves Neelix. She would have been there. So,
prior to his death, though, they did give the grounding information that the time that he was helping with, Wellman's daughter, with helping her with their monster issue. That's how the explanation of the Great Forest came about.
Right.
Was that he explained it to her as a happy place where she could go where there were no monsters to get her.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, the daughter, Naomi, she, but, I mean, that's the thing is, you realize that Neelix has such a, emotional tie to everybody in the ship, to the Naomi, the young girl, to, you know,
her mother. Seven, to everybody. He's just,
he kind of like, puts everybody together there. So, it's just one of those things where you realize what a person's worth on a crew. So Neelix has the strong connection, emotional ties, not just to Naomi, but the young girl, but also through the whole ship. And that's where we see Neelix's importance, maybe more than anything, of part of the Voyager crew, is that his emotional ties to everybody. I mean, yes, he has other things he does. He cooks. I don't know.
No one seems to like it, but he does cook.
Yeah, everyone's always complaining about his cooking.
He attempts to feed the
crew. He can't make pizza, so I mean, like, that's a major loser for me, and it was for Tom.
Yeah.
Also, I'm like, you can't make pizza, man? Oh, man.
Right. So, yeah, so he has this crisis of faith, and I think that's probably the most important thing about this whole episode, other than his emotional attachments to everyone in the crew, is that, he almost completely comes unhinged when he feels that his beliefs are hollow, like they don't, I mean, whether they are or not, that's a different story.
He does come unhinged because obviously. After he does the spirit walk with Chakotay, the vision quest, he tries to commit suicide.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, he definitely comes unhinged, but I mean, just.
It's like, I'm going to use the regular transporter, but I'm going to do a site-to-site just in case.
I mean, like the happiest guy on the ship that literally keeps everybody in check is the one that checked out or tries to check out.
Yeah, exactly.
But luckily, Naomi Wildman can't sleep any night ever. It's that 1.5-year-old girl who looks like she's 6.
Yeah. It's a strange thing. No, but I mean, there's a lot of depth to the story other than the
that's what alien. She's the 1.5-year-old girl that looks 6 or whatever. And I said, that's what alien kids do. They grow up so fast.
Yes.
Ask Tess.
The writers make them grow up fast so that they can write stories for them.
Right, exactly.
Right.
Naomi's got more screen time collectively than her mom does.
Yeah, she does, actually.
Oh, yeah.
Although, one of the things I was thinking about when we watched the episode was that, is it just normal for kids to be scared of everything? Like, isn't that, fostered between, kids communicating with other kids and telling them stories and trying to freak out the other kids? She's the only child on Voyager. So,
no,
where would she...
That's common among kids because they have a hyperactive imagination. What to us is a sheet on a bed could be a ghost or a mountain that... they have to climb, or like this great cave. I mean, it's a million and one different things. They see things in a whole different way than what we see it.
But the context of ghosts and monsters and things like that, wouldn't that be spread, in the fiction and other things that children talk with each? She's got no other children.
Well, they are.
It's not from children. we learn our stories from adults.
But aren't, remember, they are on Voyager. So there are real monsters.
She reads. Oh, yeah, she plays the logs.
Yeah, so I mean, anything's possible.
She like tunes into the view screen when like the caissons show up or something.
Oh my god!
Oh, one of my other favorite things about this episode was 7 of 9 was like, we didn't assimilate the caissons; they were worthless.
Yeah, they were such a crap race. I hated those guys.
She's like, they weren't even worth assimilating. Neelix is all like, oh well.
You would detract from perfection.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, that's basically worthless.
Yeah, that's more than worthless right there.
They'll only add to you really bad hair, like the Ancient Aliens guy.
Yeah, I always scratch my head about what the Kazon, but so we were just the Kazon, the crappy race of the Delta Quadrant.
Well, they would have been cool if they would have followed the original vision of like them being like punk kids.
We'll just edit this.
Yeah,
we'll edit the Kazon out of Voyager. Yep. A Voyager director's cut.
take them out, right.
It's like just Seska by herself taking over everything and all the Seska Kazon episodes. It's like she's like talking to herself. They edited Kenzer. She's talking to Kenzer and not really the Kazon.
Right.
Because his face looks like their hair. Yeah. So,
so Faith, why don't you, because this is an episode that you wanted to talk about, why don't you kind of expand on the things that the different aspects that you really liked about this?
One of the, when I first watched this episode, like the very first time, I actually walked away from it very confused and not really sure how I should, you know, take that, because to me it felt very open-ended. But when I watched it again recently, I had a lot of, 7 years later, and a lot of different perspective, I came away with it with a completely stronger, different meaning. And for me, it gave you a profound awareness of where you are in your social environment, of how we undervalue ourselves without intending, because we don't see where we fit within not just society, but life itself. Like that's not something that we can see very clearly from where we stand. But sometimes it takes a life-altering course, or, you know, just that moment of jarring impact to shift your perception, have to be able to see where you truly stand in it all. And sometimes people aren't capable of processing it properly at the time. But for me, it gave me that very profound awareness of, well, we really do mean a lot more than we realize in our lives, and that things might not be turning out the way that we wanted them to, but it still has its own beautiful evolution.
That's a good point. Yeah. And it's definitely one of the things, like, that's one thing I picked up immediately watching, is that Neelix's ties to people and how he impacted people on a daily basis.
And I did like how Chakotay told him when he was on the transporter pad that even 7 of 9, who has no social graces whatsoever, understands how important you are to the cohesion of the crew.
Right. Yeah.
How important he was. I liked the visual at the end, too, because towards the end you get the perception that they weren't waiting for him at the tree, because it wasn't, he already had his people that needed him. Mm-hmm. And then you see Naomi sitting in this beautiful sacred glen all on her own, and it's kind of like, it gives you the perception that this is a place that is for the people that need to be sheltered. And then when you reach a certain part in your personal evolution, you become that tree where everybody is sheltered.
That's very poetic.
Because for Neelix, he's someone that gathers everybody together. He's what everybody rotates around.
He became the tree.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
That was the realization I walked away with this last time, is that is what Neelix is.
And the second thing that hit me with the whole episode was obviously just his faith coming into question after his death. Seemed like a very strong theme to me, that he hadn't questioned, like, what is, you know, like he had the vision in the vision quest, you know, his sister saying it's not real, none of it was real, you just held on to it as, you know, to shelter yourself from the harsh realities of the universe and stuff like that.
And the horrible fate of most of his people, including his sister.
Yeah.
And rotting in front of him, like, yeah, the whole scare you bit, I mean, that was pretty intense for Star Trek.
Yeah.
Like, I remember the first time I saw that, it actually scared me. I was like, whoa, wait a minute.
Yeah.
That's not what my show does.
Rotting corpses.
Yeah, it was shocking.
it has a strong thing. I kind of think they left it his, as I think they do often with Star Trek, especially later on. I don't know, maybe all throughout Star Trek, is that they kind of left it open-ended of, like, if, was his faith valid or invalid? You know, I think, Faith, your point is that his faith symbolically meant a lot more, you know, how you're saying at the very end scene with Naomi by the tree. But
his personal feelings and faith is left open. It's never resolved. It's like he comes to the understanding that he is needed and doesn't selfishly take his own life.
Yeah, there's no clear resolution. It's definitely open for interpretation. And like I, as I noticed, you know, as my life changed and my perceptions and the way I see my life changed and gave me that additional life experience, the way what I took away from that show changed as well, which is the nice thing about it being open-ended is it lets people take away what they can apply.
And did you have some insight in this episode for us, Larry?
No, absolutely none. No, I'm kidding.
Well, thank you for coming on tonight. thank you for joining us in this episode of Synthaholics.
Immortal Coil.
Immortal Coil.
No, but I had forgotten about this show till like doing this, and I dive back into my notes, even though some of them are all over the place, Memory Alpha and elsewhere. But there's a lot that, gee whiz, guess, didn't fit in that original article, so I didn't do it. But what I did remember, and this is something I've carried for years, I just remembered this is where it started. This was, I went back to my, I pulled the notes for that interview out of my first, like, sit down for the full year interview with Brian Fuller, Mr. Brian Fuller of, you know, Pushing Daisies and Wonder Falls and now Hannibal.
Wow.
And one thing I'd always remember about Brian on his Trek days when we first talked was he was talking about one of his themes he liked to play with in shows was death and different ramifications of that. And,
I wouldn't have figured for Hannibal, but
yeah.
Yeah.
I don't see how that fits into Hannibal.
Well,
I thought it was just about someone who liked to cook.
Think about like everything he did, and then like Pushing Daisies was all about the guy that, you know, brought you back from anyway.
Yeah,
just really hit me as his career unfolded. It was like, my God, yeah, everything he does has some angle of death to it. But this is online a lot about how this started with the woman that pitched it as Naomi Wildman being killed, and they saved her with the Borg nanoprobes, and then she was not quite all there, and she wanted to kill her daughter and bring her back so they would be together, and they were talking about it being kind of Pet Sematary-ish, and the writing staff was all thrilled about it. And then he's writing away on it. And then he gets a weekend call, like from Brannon, saying, "You know, wait a minute, stop. Rick doesn't like it. The studio doesn't like it. They're not thrilled to see a young mother die and then try to kill her daughter."
Yeah.
Oh, come on, like, Rick. Oh. Come on.
I guess we can see that. So then they switched it to Chakotay about him not having his Native American, whatever they were making it up to be that week, you know. funeral and death legends play out, and then somebody said, "Oh, we shouldn't go down there," because they'd had this Native American. This is, I keep meaning to write about this, and I need to find some old memos. But there was a guy named Jamaica Highwater, and the reason everybody now is going back and saying this was just a big mush is because they had an advisor who was telling them not to make it specific and to invent all this Native American stuff. So now it comes off as being fake and ungenuine. That wasn't their initial take. They initially wanted to go find real tribes and real beliefs and real terms and use them, and they kept getting advised not to. Well, it's turned out the guy advising them and advising Hollywood for 30 years was kind of a fake, which is just a wacky story.
Oh,
that's
man.
Crazy.
So, yeah. So they went, oh, we shouldn't touch the Native American thing. So then they made it about Neelix. Like, well, Neelix is an alien, and he's the comedy relief that people love to kick around, and no one will care if we insult his – make up his
– his beliefs, right. Right. Yeah.
So they made all that up, and that's kind of what's out in the notes. What I'd forgotten until I was reading my interview with him was this all happened right when Brian had done like one or two – he was only had done like a show or two. So he was still like on his 13-week option of his first time on the staff. Really.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And this all happened. He kept getting these calls to like stop what you're doing and change. Then stop what you're doing and change right when he was like a few days away from his renewal time. Like, will we keep him or not?
Oh,
you know?
Wow.
Yeah.
So they had the screws to him, so he kind of felt like he had to.
Well, they were just under the gun to get a show done, and it was just his assignment. And is somebody going to take it away from him, or is he going to be competent and pull through, or does he need a helper, or, you know, all the fixes that they do, and they picked out Neelix. He says, and I'm looking at my notes here, and this is what hasn't been quoted anywhere, so here's something new for you. He says, I've written all this really cool Native American stuff that I was really into, really attached to, and I thought, wow, this is great. And I had Seven talking about how it doesn't make any sense to her, and she was comparing her spirituality to Chakotay's, the Borg version of what it would be to be spiritual. So all that gets thrown away. And in the meeting, I was just silent. And Jerry's saying, like, well, you're not talking much, Brian. Well, I'm sorry. I'm just concentrating on breathing because I was, like, in this panic attack. I have 9 days before I find out if I'm renewed, and I have 4 days to complete a page one first draft. I'm going to buckle big time. I come up to my office, and Jill Sherwin, who was the DS9 assistant, I wanted to get a glass of water, and I must have looked like death, and she came down here and gave me a huge pep talk. And I was like, I'm fucked. I'm just getting off the ground, and my plane's going to crash and burn. It was just overwhelming. It was like, oh, my God, it was awful. But I burrowed into it, and I wrote the first draft in 4 days, which was like going on 3 hours of sleep a day. It was just insane. And I said, did anybody realize your 14 weeks is about up? And just, yeah, but it was like, just get the thing done. So I wrote the first draft, and then Brandon and I wrote the second draft because time constraints. It was insane. It was impossible for one person to do, and I just knew I was going to be walking. I thought, my first chance, I get a chance, and I blow it. It could have been a worse situation to be tested by. I mean, oh, my God. But he pulled through it, and it worked out. And then Johnny, Ethan Phillips, did a great, great job in the show, and that helped it along, and now it came out, and people loved it and covered it. But he talks about how it was a reflection of his life because he had been raised Catholic and turned 18 and said, sorry, Mom, I don't believe any of this stuff. How it was personal on that kind of a level, but how it, you know, became something bigger and they had to invent the Talaxian stuff. And
right, but I can definitely sense that from the story itself, that it was somebody realizing maybe they something happens in their life and they realize maybe the faith that they had doesn't have as much impact as they originally thought it would. And, you know, I think I know personally I've gone through that. I know other people have too, is that you have this, thing of faith where you're just like, maybe that's not what it's not how I think it is. So, we all have different faiths, and I don't like to step on anybody's belief system, but yeah, it's definitely it some of those points hit home, and that's probably the biggest thing that my takeaway was, Neelix is confronting his faith and trying to figure out what it means and what his life means afterward if his faith is hollow, you know. But that's an interesting backstory.
Yeah, and it was definitely well performed. I mean, as much as I don't care for Neelix, Ethan Phillips is an amazing actor, and his performance is extremely strong in this episode. And I remember reading on Memory Alpha that he's like, man, I wish I could get one of these episodes every year.
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah, no.
Well, it's good to see the token. I mean, that's one thing they kept flying against. Like, that's what Armin did on DS9 with Quark, and Billingsley on Enterprise with Phlox. It was like the guy with the makeup is the and probably Ethan had it the worst of all with the hedgehog, you know, thing going on. It was like, how do you overcome the teddy bear goofy alien thing and be able to play stuff straight as much as the humans?
I don't know.
Or just things naturally gravitate to, oh, we can't have a human do this. We have to have an alien do it for, you know, X, Y, or Z reason in a given show. And, you know, and just playing against that. Because he's naturally perky, and that's kind of what the character was supposed to be. But yeah, for him to be able to do that. And of course, he got a hit. You know, Jatrell real early was kind of that way. In fact, it kind of threw people, I think. It was like first season, like, what? He's not supposed to be the comic relief all the time? And he did get a few of these. But going back to Brian Fuller and Death, this also got me thinking that, now that I think about it, because I was thinking about Brandon's show in the first season about the planet with the culture, with their afterlife. Yeah. And how it was very scientific, and they took people away, and they just beamed their remains to a nebula.
Yeah, to that moon place or whatever. Yeah.
A parturition? Parturition.
Yeah.
And then at the end, they go, well, you know what? We've recorded a little poof of something every time they go there. And they're like, oh, well, maybe that is their soul after all. You know, but Voyager, if you think about parturition, but if you think about Jatrell, if you think about Mortal Coil, if you think later on about Barge of the Dead – where you get into B'Elanna's Klingon stuff, and it's all poetic and heroic because everybody knows the Klingon stuff and it was fun to build on it, but still at the core of it, it was about her seeing her mother, you know, in Stovokor, and she hadn't done a life, so she couldn't get in, you know, because she hadn't been heroic. And if you think about B'Elanna trying, you talk about the suicide end of things, B'Elanna trying to kill herself in Day of Honor.
Yeah.
When she found out all the McKee had been obliterated back during the Dominion War and they got the news of it. Voyager had a lot of like death looking, you know, mortality looking episode. Oh, Coda, where
yeah.
Janeway's, you know, it's about a fake alien's fake thing to get to Janeway, but they used mortality and seeing her dead dad.
Yep.
You know, yeah. And it's kind of spooky, bizarre. Voyager, and through different eras of writers, not even the same generations of writers, like repeating over and over, but Voyager had a lot of, I guess because they were lost so far from home, maybe it lent itself to that. But Voyager had a lot of really dark-looking episodes that way.
Yeah.
And not just because moments. Of Brian Fuller's, you know, death-writing fetish or whatever.
Voyager liked to make the individual think. Like, there are a lot of episodes, like the Week of Hell, the 1-2-part episode.
Year of Hell. Where, such a good episode.
Where they virtually lose the entire crew, and then all of a sudden, at the very end, magic wand, everything's reset. But halfway through those two episodes, you're sitting there going, how do we get back from this? I mean, there's a lot of moments like that in Voyager that really just shook your world and made you look at not just the show, but how you perceive everything in a completely different fashion, because it forced you into that perspective.
Yeah.
And that was definitely the unique thing with Voyager, is it was very, very deep mind probing in a lot of its episodes.
Yeah, when you start reflecting on mortality, that's probably about as deep as you get. You know, it's like you're thinking, this is, you know, what's the end? What's my legacy? What's, you know, I think we all go through that at some point in our life. You know, and you have to reflect on what those things mean and what your life has meant, and then what comes afterward. Does anything come afterward? You know, all that stuff.
What impact have I made?
Yeah.
And will I be remembered? Did I do anything worthwhile?
Right.
Am I worthwhile? You know, there's a whole series of questions there.
Yeah, I know.
Exactly. And good thing 7 of 9 used to be part of the Borg, because that she'll live forever. until the collective falls apart, I suppose.
Yeah. Until the nanobots stop working.
More dedicated to logic than any Vulcan you can find.
I thought that was pretty interesting that Seven had a view of afterlife or whatever. It's like, yeah, I'll die, but I'll never really die as long as the Borg are around. Like,
yeah, because her...
It's like, can we all get assimilated and then just get unassimilated? It's like, yeah, we're all living forever.
Yeah, but isn't...
Like,
well,
having a fax copy of yourself somewhere.
Yeah, isn't that the whole idea, is like if you believe you're going to go to heaven, you know, it's like just your conscience going up, and it's, you know, you being in heaven. So it's sort of like
here's your data file.
Yeah, here's your data file, and it's up there somewhere, uploaded in the cloud.
You can Velcro these wings onto your data file.
There you go.
Well, but you know,
you have skins for your data file.
Of all the different ways they've revived people on Star Trek, they never like got someone's consciousness back from the Borg and put it into a new body or something like that.
Right.
Of ways to revive people. I mean, it just seems like it could have been something they could have done. I mean, it would be like an old version of them, but it would still be them.
Right. Right.
If it was Seven, you have to reteach her how to be. Not collectivized.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
see, if they had met the Borg earlier in the alt universe, in JJ's universe, then instead of stupid, you know, Tribble blood, you could have whatever magic blood from from the augments, you could have just, you know, brought them back with brought Kirk back with the Borg nanoprobes. But you know, maybe not.
Because nanoprobes are the option, the solution for everything.
Right.
something Borg.
Species, they can bring you back. They can do just about anything.
Something nanoprobe.
Nanoprobes. The Delta Quadrant's wonder drug. Yeah.
That's how you really fly.
Well, yeah, I mean, but 7 of 9, definitely, I think they invented the cloud before the cloud became a thing, so... You know, her consciousness has been uploaded in the cloud. There's been a lot of talk about that anyways. You know, I've been reading about people like, you know, what if you could, you know, upload your experiences and consciousness to a computer and then...
That's what Facebook is.
Yeah, exactly. It just keeps on living on, you know.
I'm having dinner. Click.
There's not a storage file large enough to upload that sort of data. Like, that's a huge amount of data.
Well, once Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter all become one the same app, then that's our life experience.
Or they make the quantum computer finally gets released, and everyone has one. So, if that ever happens.
That would be amazing.
Like the Schizoid Man.
Yeah, exactly. Schizoid Man, exactly. He's got himself in the computer.
To know him is to love him is to know him.
Oh, wow. I love that episode.
I love that show.
I just had this image of what would it be? Instafacegram saying, open the pod bay doors, Hal. I mean, you know, I was just...
Yeah, I know.
Exactly.
Wow. I knew that, I guess, is what Instafacegram
would Instafaceware.
Just, yeah.
Tweet my facegram.
It just does it for you. Well, it's definitely...
No, I was going to say, there for a while in the early, like, aughts TV shows that wanted to do Facebook or MySpace or anything, and they would, rather than just using something, they were so afraid of it being new and, like, you know, commercially endorsing it, they would like, make up a social media platform, and they would, you know, like, they'd call it FaceSpace or MyBook or something.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Yeah.
But now nobody even cares. It's like, it's just out there.
Anyone see that horrible looking movie trailer for Unfriended, the horror movie where, like, some girl died on Facebook and then the ghost of her starts killing people?
No, I didn't see that.
I only saw the preview. I didn't actually see the movie, but I'm just like, oh.
There's a lot of different iterations of that type of story going on. You'll be killed by this viral video meme.
Okay. And I'm like, when?
The Nyan Cat will get you.
I'm waiting.
Yeah, anytime.
We're 7 days and counting.
Yeah, come on.
What was the limit on this?
You promise.
Don't tease me with a good time. Come
you
on.
Promise me to kill me. I Mortal Coil, I think it definitely had a little more impact than I thought after I first started watching it. Like, because at the end, like, you're like,
you
oh.
said you fell asleep when you first started.
Stop. I never said that. Shut up.
Uh-huh. Oh, you see, the thing is I believe David, though.
Oh, all right. What else have you been saying about me? But
I'll look up that text. You said I'm pretty sure you said you fell asleep.
No, but it's one of those things where it's just like you see it in the beginning. You're like, okay, you know, this is kind of just like going to be a Neelix thing, and then it starts like Neelix died, and I'm like,
your eyes get big, and you're
through the first 20 minutes.
Your heart's filled with joy.
Yeah, and then it.
Don't tease me like
that. Yeah, no.
And then they brought him back, and then Aaron was like, "Ah,
oh. Yeah." And then he's threatening to commit suicide. Then you get your hopes up again, and then it's like,
You know, it's just one of those things that. But I do enjoy that they. It's one thing that, and you know, Larry, you were mentioning it before, is that when you can't talk about a hot topic that you know is going to be, you know, maybe. Offend people or mm-hmm. that they throw an alien in the mix to make it less you know
more palatable.
Yeah, and I think sci-fi always does this. I mean, this is a common thing. It's just to make us like look from the outside what it looks like.
Well, that's pure Gene starting Star Trek in the first place.
Yeah,
in the '60s. Yeah.
Dancing around the you know the censors. Or by, you know, not the censors, but, you know, like being able to tell stories you wanted to tell without literally telling them and getting in trouble.
Yeah, no, I mean, because it's you know, it's just perfect that you can tell those stories and then nobody's going to get offended. But you do sit back and you go, oh, wow, you know, what does that mean for me? Or what does that mean for, you know, my belief system? And
it's approachable. It's not putting you on. Well, I found some more bits here from... Brian that I didn't use anywhere published, so they're not on Memory Alpha, but they will be now. They're listening to you guys. He says, what would be worse than having your dead grandmother come back and saying, you know, there is no God. You know, all this is a figment of your imagination. You're going to die, and there's nothing. You disappear, and you go that way. So, see ya. So that's one thing I think speaks to a lot of fears, and in a way that Star Trek does best. It turns a secular element that runs through everyone's lives and turns it on its ear and tells in a different way that you can appreciate and you won't be offended by it. Because if we did that with a Catholic who did that, people would be pissing in their pants. They can't do that. That's not right. Because it's this little hedgehog guy from outer space doing it, then it's more palatable, and then you can get it in the back door.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah, exactly.
Neutral ground.
Yeah, absolutely.
It gives you a neutral ground for a really hot topic that everybody can approach.
Well, they could have used the Qatari, even though it was Naomi's mom, they could have used the Qatarian beliefs. Maybe she was a Qatarian convert. She didn't have to be Catholic or something.
And he's like a key element of the crew, so he made a logical...
Right.
But I mean, I was just saying, like, you know, that's the way they could have gotten around, you know, using Naomi's mom. Maybe she's adopted Qatarian beliefs. That way it's not like, you know...
Highly unlikely.
Yeah, you know, she just thought he was hot or something.
Yeah.
That would have been mentioned more often, though, earlier in the show.
Yeah.
at least once.
Given the choice between the alien dad who we'll never see because he's back at DS9 versus a guy who's in the cast who could stand some not comic stuff, then they're going to...
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
At least two-thirds of the fan population cheering on the death.
Yeah.
Wait, he dies in this episode? I'm here.
Fast forward, rewind.
I gotta make a gif of him dying constantly.
I knew you guys would take something away from this.
I know.
No, you know, I get spiritual, you know, reawakening, and you guys get.
Well, you see, that's.
Can you find another drinking game meme in here somewhere? Yeah,
there should be.
Oh, yeah, that's a good idea.
Well, you know, I've also mentioned I usually like to complain about continuity when things don't match up right, and that's part of the Synthaholics drinking game. If David says something about continuity,
right.
Definitely take a shot or two.
Did you have a problem with continuity in this one? I don't think there's anything that blows a hole through anything.
No.
No, it's pretty streamlined. Just a little open-ended at the end, but very...
Oh, well, the actress playing Naomi's different.
Well, this is actually the first time, this is the first time Naomi had been in the show since she was born, like a year and a half earlier. So did they even make a reference to, it's like Klingons that grow up fast.
Yeah. They were talking to the doctor.
So this girl was like the youngest thing they could get to not just look really old. And she had a couple of lines or whatever. But this girl's name was Brooke Stevens, and they wouldn't do Naomi for another year. And then that's when... Scarlett Palmer's started doing it in Once Upon a Time, and then she had it like for the rest. They just kind of, it's like they gave you a taste every year. Oh, look, that year and a half kid is really 4. Oh, look, that year and a half year old kid's really 7.
Man, she looks like she's 10 now.
Yeah.
Just enough to make it easier to bridge the gap and then make it normal.
I was just hoping there was like a...
Those alien kids grew up so fast.
Yeah.
I was just hoping there's a time gap. But there was an episode where you see... little Naomi and in season 6 and Janeway, they're christening the new warp engine that'll get them home quicker, and then they end up not being able to use it. But they say it's been 6 years. I'm like, I guess there isn't a gap then. Naomi's still like, you know, 4.
But this you're talking about continuity and canon. This was they actually did, and Brian was doing this, and he was trying. And the fact that he's writing it under the gun is amazing. But they go back and reference the Metreon Cascade from Jatrell, which is kind of nice, you know. And his sister—they never named any of his family, and this is the only time anybody ever gets mentioned. And his sister Alexia, she gets named here. They refer to her once more, but this is the only time any of his family ever gets named. And they, in Once Upon a Time, he says he's writing her a letter every night, even though you know it's way. And the fact that they use Prixum as the feast. That was in Jerry Taylor's other novel. Jerry Taylor wrote 2 novels. One was about Janeway, and one was about the rest of the characters. And supposedly everything in the novels was canon. But when Jerry went off at the end of retired from everything 4 years in, people tended not to go back and look at her. The newer writers didn't go back and look at her stuff. But Brian, Pathways had not come out yet, but she had the manuscript, and he actually pulled Prixum from her manuscript before it was published. Which was – so if you read the book, you probably thought it had been on TV and then – came out. But it was like one of the last times that they actually went into her book to get something. Like, I need a thing. I need a festival for Talaxians. Oh, look, you've got Prixum in here. Okay, we'll do it.
Wow.
But then did you also hear when Seven is talking about Neelix and she says his lung singular?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes.
From when the...
Which was a nice thing back to... So, like, don't ever say... Like, of all the mess on canon that Voyager wound up having, and they had, like, 5 turnovers of head writers, or 4, maybe... Brian's doing his job here. Brian's fanboy enough to go back and get stuff. So they've got him with a single lung back from Phage. And this is the thing, though. Let me read the whole damn story, Larry, in your notes. Actually, had lungs, plural, and Ethan and Picardo were doing the scene on stage, and they said they saw lungs, and they said, wait a minute, Neelix only has 1 lung. and they called over and got permission to only say lung singular. So the actors caught it and changed it.
Oh, nice.
Here's your minutia story of the day.
That's awesome.
The actors realized that it's like, hey, this is wrong. I only have
one
lung.
That's really cool.
That's really good that they cared enough to remember that. That's awesome.
That's cool. It's
and, you know, Ethan's going, I need one of these one, you know, can I have more than one a year? So he's going to really bear down. He's not just, you know, serving cookies in the mess hall in this one. So
yeah,
exactly.
Here's your pseudo coffee.
Here's your Leola root omelet. So,
tastes like dirt.
Tastes like dirt.
Yeah. Dirt, the other white meat.
This has some crunchy flavor. You need that texture.
Leola dirt root.
Oh, my God.
Hey, it's edible. Doesn't taste good, but you can eat it.
Yeah.
It's edible, it's just not palatable.
Yeah. Well, this has been a great episode, you know, just to talk about, because it does bring all these different things in mind. And I always love when Star Trek makes you think a little deeper about things than I like the standard adventure stories too here and there, but I do like when there's an undercurrent or something else. So this
there's a co-janitor to kind of clean things up.
The co-janitor that cleans up the messes, yes. So, yeah.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show with us tonight, Larry, and giving us all this great rundown on all the current projects you're working on and some insight into Mortal Coil.
Yeah, definitely. Stuff that we know.
Yeah, it was a definite pleasure.
Thanks, guys. I was like going, Mortal Coil? Why more? Okay. And then I got into it. Oh, okay. Well, this is good refresher. Yeah. And like, just get back in your own stuff, Larry. And it's, you know, but I was kind of amused to see how much was just, you know, word for word. Yeah. On the internet. It's like, well, duh, it was in the article you did. So, yeah, I guess it would be. Kind of comes around, sir. But no, it's thanks for letting me talk about Enterprise and Space and especially Portal 47. I hope everybody goes over and takes a look. And,
oh yeah! If you shoot me over those links, I'll put them all in the show notes.
I should say I'm way behind on putting some new interviews up on my blog on treklandblog.com at my website at larrynemechek.com too. I've got a ton of stuff to put up, and I've just between Enterprise in Space and Portal 47 and this shoot for this week and on the Con of Wrath, and in a few weeks I'm going to be back watching and talking about the next Star Trek Continues shoot that I go back for. And anyway, I'm way behind on taking care of my business. I've got so many little families of people to take care of or tend to that I've been neglecting just the people that enjoy my blog videos and posts, and I'm behind. So I've got a bunch of stuff from this summer to put up. And when I should, real quick, a shout out to the Red Shirt Diaries. I'm going to be coming up on one of those very soon in a surprise kind of a surprise and also a throwback way. So I just, if anybody is not familiar with them, really cute, and they're very digestible. They're only like 3-4 minutes long a piece in 1 week. So
yeah, I've mentioned it on the podcast before, right around when she started season 2. I kind of want to talk to her and see if I can get her on the show too.
Yeah, it's definitely a fun show. Very cool.
Oh, that's awesome! You're going to be on it. I can't wait to see that.
I kind of think she's eager. Yeah, kind of think that. Anyway, I'm in like one of the last episodes of their quote unquote season, so I think the next to last one. So I'm actually in Operation Annihilate, so wearing a blue tunic.
Oh, nice,
nice.
Do you steal your tunic from the Star Trek Continues?
I don't steal anything. I have the ones I took home with me. So.
Oh, okay.
Well, the ones you were assigned. I didn't mean steal as in like, you know, theft. But, you know, just like, you know.
I do it with all my hotel towels.
But you leave the soap.
Yeah, I leave the soap. Yeah.
Coolest hotel towel ever.
Yeah. Yeah, but Larry, thank you so much for coming.
Thanks a lot, guys. I should just say my Facebook is Larry Nemechek's Trekland, and my and then there's a Con of Wrath Facebook. And if there's any collectors, a lot of my archival stuff, set plans and first drafts and promotional stuff and things like that, I have a Facebook page called the Trekland Trunk. And I don't like going around being slimy used car guy around the internet, so I put some stuff up for sale on eBay, and I have a little 3-hour thing on Sundays most weeks. And if you just go to the Facebook page or the Twitter, the Trekland Trunk Twitter, I just say, hey, this is up now, and if you're interested, then you'd hear about it, and if you don't, it doesn't have to come into your face. And But I've got some regulars that come by and people stumble by every once in a while. So if you're that interests you, come, you know, come by there too.
Awesome.
Otherwise, my main Twitter is just Larry Nemechek, and there's a little politics and a little Will Rogers and a little OU football in there, but it's hopefully mostly Star Trek.
Very awesome. Cool.
Well, yeah, thanks for coming on, Larry, and you know, we're going to be excited to see all your new projects that you're working on.
Yeah, and hopefully we can have you back on once the Con of Wrath is out. We've all seen it. We can talk about that a little bit more in detail once we know what it's all about, once we've seen it and experienced it.
Okay, that would be awesome. And if I could sometime maybe coming down, I'd love to come on maybe with one or two guys from Enterprise in Space and
that would be amazing.
That would be fantastic.
That'd be really cool.
We would love that.
Okay.
I mean, that way we can spend a whole episode on it.
Show. They're all the thing about the Enterprise in Space guys is everybody. People are in education, they're in engineering, they're in, you know, project management, but the thing they almost all share is they all, the department heads at least, all are also like sci-fi and especially Star Trek fans. So that kind of little thing fires, they're all living examples of people who were inspired to go into their jobs by Star Trek and if nothing, if not Star Trek, at least like future looking optimistic sci-fi.
Yeah.
So, you know, going into the future. That's very cool too.
That's the best.
Down the line, sometime I'll take you up on that.
That's the best child of Star Trek there is.
Yeah, just exactly. Yeah, definitely let me know. I mean, it'd be great to spend a whole episode getting to talk about that with you and the guys working on that project with you. Cool. So just hit me up whenever you'd like to do that. We'll work it out.
Okay.
Awesome.
Okay, very good. But guys, but again, thanks for coming on or coming on, having me.
Oh, Larry Nemechek has been running the Synthaholics podcast all along.
Good. That's one more job you have to do.
It's I'll like add you to the producers list.
Yeah, thanks. I've got more than I can say grace over already. I should say we're going to be starting a we are. Since you say that, we're starting a podcast for EIS, and I'm going to co-host. It's called Uplink, and we started to do it last spring, and we had so much going on that we held up. And here in the next month or two, we're going to launch that with the team and with people that are partners and with people who have just interesting bits in education and science and tangent things to what the spirit of Enterprise in Space is about. So so there's a little plug for that coming down the line too.
Very
one
cool.
more thing on my plate though.
There you go. One more thing to do.
Nice.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Larry.
Yeah, thanks again, guys.
It's very pleasure talking to you.
It was really great getting to meet you and getting to speak with you.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time.
All right. Bye-bye.
Have a good night.
Bye.
Thank you all for listening. All my music is provided by Warp 11. You can find them at warp11.com or follow them on Twitter at warp11. You can find us at synthaholics.com. You can email us at synthaholics@yahoo.com. And you can follow us on Twitter at synthaholicduo. If you'd like to follow us individually, you can follow me at David_J_Duncan.
You can follow me, Aaron O'Brien, at Blackbird2004. Faith, where can they find you?
You can find me at Faith Hertzberg.
And please subscribe to us. We are on iTunes. We are on Stitcher. And if you have a chance, please rate and review so we can improve. And any feedback is welcome. And so we can make the show even better for you.
Live long and prosper, guys. At the stars we did gaze. The next morning he left stinking of gin. Well, McCoy, my boy, come mix me a drink. Before the night's over, I'll puke in the sink. And we'll cry till we laugh. And we'll both shit our pants. You're the best drinking friend.